Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
Can I welcome Stuart Pickles to Just Not Good Enough? Stuart and I go back 30 years or so to when we were both living in Japan. And ironically, I suppose, our careers have intertwined periodically. And it got to the point, didn't it, where you and I were commuting from two villages 3 miles apart in Cotswolds to Twickenham, both of us to Twickenham for, what, 3 years, 4 years or something? And we never bloody knew, you know, and we've known each other for so long. I mean, it's ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, what was your take on all of that then? I mean, the journey time and living away from home, because you and I both bought flats separately. How did that affect you and your family?
Oh, well, that's a good place to start, isn't it? Yeah, that was not the easiest of times. We were up in that neck of the woods just recently, actually, Sarah and I, and I was, you know, just reflecting back on, I think for me it was about 6 years in total that I was living away Monday to Friday and away from the family, and not the easiest of times. So I did things like, I mean, I think you went to the theatre every night, more or less.
No, Tuesdays, Richmond Theatre, Tuesdays, J5.
Oh, Tuesdays.
Yeah, J5.
I went, there was an open air swimming pool just down the road in Hampton, and I went swimming every single day.
Did you?
That was one of the things that, helped me sort of lift my spirits in those dark, especially in the dark, cold midwinter evenings.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah, morning. I wouldn't do it then. So, I mean, did you struggle through that just because you were essentially on your own for 5-6 days a week?
Well, I would say that it was not easy. I'd also come, prior to that, we'd been living in Melbourne in Australia and living by the beach, so the contrast couldn't have been starker. They weren't easy times, but I suppose you compartmentalize things, don't you, and make the most of it. And, you know, I had some good mates at work. You were one of them for a while. And then I had other friends living in London. So it was, you know, I used to catch up with people. But and since then, you know, the kids have talked about how, now that they're adults, you know, kind of how difficult that was for them as well. And, you know, that was what was always going on in my mind and in my heart, you know, not being there for the kids all the time. I think that's the price that a lot of, let's face it, a lot of leaders and business people, you know, price they pay for doing the right thing,
you know. Yeah. I mean, because I've always struggled with this dichotomy between being part of the family and being the breadwinner and being ambitious. Yeah. And in some ways they don't happen. You can't manage all of that all at once. One gives way to the other, and for me particularly, doing that weekly commute for, I think I did it for 5 years actually, put immense strain on Sue and the two kids. You know, they were going through proper school years with GCSEs and A levels and so on, so we couldn't move them. So my sacrifice was to go up there and do that, which played a toll on my mental health, I must admit. Although I didn't quite realise it at the time. And God knows what it did to the family, because I wasn't really there. And even then, when I was there at the weekends, it was, you know, I was knackered, not feeling so good, working myself up into, Christ, I've got Monday morning, I've got to get up really early and go into work, thinking about what the week's going to bring. So you're a bit absent, actually.
It's funny, because I always sort of rationalized and justified to myself that, you know, I made up for it on the weekends by having quality time with my kids. But I was talking to my eldest son a few weeks ago, and he was saying, God, you were so grumpy when you used to come home on a Friday. You were really not fun to be with.
I'm laughing. I shouldn't laugh, because that's exactly what I got. How was holidays for you? Because I always found the first 3 days of a holiday were absolute hell.
Oh yeah. That was always a thing, wasn't it? And you know, if you had a week's holiday, it was barely coming up for air, I think, before you sort of, you know, kind of felt like you had to go back down again to start thinking about the Monday when you're back. And
But I tended to slip into, as I now realise, into a depression for at least 3 or 4 days. You know, and you look forward to your holidays, and then when you get there, you feel like shit for half the first week, and then you never really quite get out of it. I don't. Did you ever experience anything like that?
Well, I don't know, Chaz, whether I've experienced depression the way you have. It sounds like, you know, you really have had some really, you know, difficult times. I mean, I believe that everybody suffers depression at some level. It's a yeah. spectrum, and you know, I'm definitely one who would. You know, could have acknowledged, again, like you, probably not so much back, you know, those several years ago. I don't think I was so consciously aware of it. But then you do know that my, you know, I think we spoke about how my father took his life and when I was 21. And so, you know, there's, I suppose I actually have always had a bit of an eye on mental health. And
does that worry you that you could be the same?
The main thing actually that caused... I think that didn't help me, and you know, in the aftermath of my dad's death, was that I said to myself I didn't want to be a failure like him, which wasn't really a very helpful frame. And actually, I think what it did is it led me to be overcompensate and work and try too hard and try to be too ambitious. And I wouldn't say that I, what would I say? But I don't think I've ever. I think I've been so clear that I wouldn't do it. I mean, that's easy to say, and you know, but I suppose, yeah, I think it's just been so much in the forefront of my mind, the awareness of and the importance of having good mental health, that I think that, you know, I was probably lucky in the sense from that. So I guess I was informed to that extent. I mean, it wasn't called mental health in those days. You know, my dad just took his life, and he was an alcoholic, and he had a failing business and a failing marriage, and so that's what happens, right? So, I think that I think ahead of time, I would say, back in the mid 90s, this is before we worked together. You know, I went for a job, and I remember it was a very kind of liberating moment, because I'd been coming from a job that was incredibly highly stressed, and I was going into another job, and I just didn't, you know, one of the reasons I was moving is that I just wanted to move to a less stressful environment, frankly. And I said in the interview, I said, look, you know, is work-life balance is important to me? Is that a problem for you?
This was in the 90s.
I think that would have been about 97.
That's way ahead. And, that's way ahead of where we are at that time.
Yeah, I mean, it is, you know, I think nowadays, obviously, that's completely normal, and thank God, and, you know, how far we've come. But I just remember how incredibly liberating it was just to be able to say it.
How did they react to that?
Well, they gave me a job. I mean,
that's a start. But in the interview itself, was there any?
Yeah, I vividly remember the guy just saying, "No problem at all. No problem at all." You know, and of course, the reaction could have been very different.
Yeah,
so it was a bit of a risk, I suppose, that I took at the time. But yeah,
wouldn't it be good if a lot of people could do that? Just feel permission to be able to say things like that in interviews.
I mean, I think a lot more people do now. Chaz, I think it's much, much more commonly known, especially in the younger generation. I think you know, it's almost a given in the lower ranks, especially the companies aren't going to be able to attract and retain good people if they're not as you know understanding about this. This is your sort of particular interest is as you move further up organisations. That ethos doesn't always stay the same. And I think even now in a lot of organizations where, you know, the lower ranks might get more airtime and more, you know, kind of credence. I think further up, I think it still can be very tough.
Do you think that's, as you know, I was at Superdry, and what we used to do is we aimed at the 18 to 25 year olds, but then you design clothes for them as they go all the way through their life. Right?
Yeah.
So you keep the brand loyalty. So is there something like that happening in business with mental health awareness, that the people who are the senior leaders of the future, you know, you've almost got to get rid of this generation, move them out the way because they're bloody dinosaurs or whatever in terms of their behavior. And then it actually in 25, 30 years time, it'll all be okay. I mean, we'll probably have another thing to worry about, but that particular aspect will be okay. Do you think that's a process that's going on?
I do think it's changing. I mean, you know, I keep having to pinch myself to remind myself that I've been working for 40 years now. And
No,
so
surely not. Surely not. You're not old enough.
I know, isn't it scary? But
Yeah, it is
you know,
actually, yeah.
it's well, nearly 40 years anyway. But it's yeah, I don't know.
There's a
I
lot
think
of.
there's definitely yeah, what I was going to say is, I mean, I you know, I was a CFO, finance director like you. I then moved and changed career completely and moved into coaching 10 years ago. And part of that was, you know, to do with, I think part of it was actually to do with not seeing enough humanity in the organizations I was working in.
Yeah.
And when I discovered coaching, I had some coaching myself, and it really helped me to get more, you know, have a more authentic conversation with myself about what I really wanted and all of that. And the reason I mentioned that in relation to this question is because, you know, I'm now coaching, and I'm coaching leaders who are 20 years younger than me and are now moving into senior positions in organizations. And, you know, they are definitely, you know, culturally and mindset wise, much, much more tuned into this stuff than the people, frankly, of our age.
So there is that happening, and you're part of making that happen, aren't you? Where the leaders of tomorrow will be much, much more aware of behavior around boardroom tables, behavior around down the organization, how you treat people, how you show compassion and empathy, and all of those sorts of things, rather than just the other side to that, of course, is the capitalist economy that says money, 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 money.
And power corrupts.
And power corrupts, and people behave, I think, to use your word, they behave like sociopaths in boardrooms.
But and that's, yeah, that's what I was going to say as well. I mean, you know, when you think about, you know, the hiring in the younger generation, and, you know, you particularly see this in the you know, the consulting firms and the accounting firms, and, you know, they'll and I even remember this in Unilever when I graduated. I came into Unilever, and the people who, you know, kind of came to the interviews and sort of and attracted us into the business were people who are like me, you know, who were in their
Yeah.
early 20s and mid 20s and all fun. And then, you know, sort of time moves on, and you suddenly realize that that's not how your career is necessarily going to be. You're going to have to work with a whole load of, you know, kind of, fairly aggressive, unpleasant people at times, you know,
But it
subject
shouldn't be
to
like that, should it? It shouldn't.
incredibly high-pressured environments. And yeah, I mean,
Because you can
you
still
know.
treat people with decency, can't you? No matter how much pressure you're under, I think.
And I think that, you know, I think that there are organizations that do. I you know, my whole, you know, kind of, I guess, role and job now is coaching leaders to be better leaders, and that starts off with questions like, what does it mean to be a good leader? And, you know, and it's, you know, I think there's always an element of kind of what is objectively morally right and good, and what is in the interest of that leader and of that business anyway. And there is actually quite a big overlap there, because, you know,
Yeah.
if you turn out to be quite, you know, engaging with your people, then lo and behold, you might get them to be motivated and to perform better. But actually, that behavior is also, you know, just morally the right way to be
Yeah.
more respectful of people, to honor their, you know, what's important for them personally, both as well as professionally, etc.
When you ask that question, what does makes a good leader? What do they say generally? I mean, are there any sort of themes that people say things? Well, no, I won't suggest anything. I'll leave it up to you.
Well, I mean, I suppose, when you start the conversation about what's a good leader, that as a coach, I'm normally asking that question of the people I'm working with, and especially when, you know, you're working in a group and you're saying, what kind of culture do you want to build, in order to be, you know, successful, and in order to create that culture, what kind of leadership would be required to create culture? Because leadership is a big part of how culture is created. And you know, it's different people have, you know, there's different leadership competency frameworks. I'm sure you're aware of this. And I think there is this kind of general shift that most people are kind of aware of and on the journey of, which is, you know, moving away from the sort of the classic hero leader, the hard driving, kind of authoritative type, to the much more kind of, you know, consultative, empowering, and more kind of empathetic leadership. And I you know, that's the prevailing wisdom in the leadership profession, but whether or not that kind of behavior always manifests, the truth is, like you say, there are some people who might be more at the sociopathic end of the spectrum, who frankly are still able to succeed because they, capitalistic, economics means that you can go into an organization and, you know, for example, you know, the most obvious example in recent times is in the UK is all of what's going on in the utilities sector, where people are just going in and being sort of, you know, ruthlessly focused on just extracting cash and, you know, without any real thought for what's going on with the environment and for the communities that they serve. And, you know, that kind of single-minded sort of capitalistic thinking, is a kind of leadership that is outmoded, but it's still there, isn't it? Still there, yeah, that's right.
You know, you think about private equity and venture capital and all of these sorts of things. That, I mean, their sole objective is to buy a business, run it lean and mean, and emphasis on mean, I guess, and sell it and make some money out of it at the end. And they don't care about how they behave towards the people that run it and so on. I mean, you've been in boardrooms quite a lot. I mean, can you sort of think about any examples where people have behaved badly, and then how did you deal with that and what happened?
Well, I probably see it more now. Sorry, I probably see it less now because when you come in as an outsider, people generally behave a bit better.
Yeah. But behind closed doors, of course, it can be very different.
It can, and you do still see it. But I'm thinking more back to my own personal experience of when there's a closed doors and there's nobody, there's no external observers, then, you know, people kind of maybe take the gloves off. And I mean, I all sorts of things. I mean, I you know, the kind of the chastisement of people not, you know, being totally on top of their brief or not presenting clearly enough or, you know, not being able to, well, most importantly, not hitting their numbers, their profit targets, their sales targets and whatever. The bullying tactics of or responses to that and, you know, being bellowed out and, you know, being told to get out of the room and, you know, that kind of stuff. Definitely saw that kind of behavior once or twice, you know, on the receiving end of some really, you know, the really hard end of that kind of behavior. And, was in tears one time in particular.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was devastating, you know, just, it's really hard, you know, and I was lucky enough to have, that came from the boss of a boss, if you know what I mean. And, I was lucky enough quite soon after that to have a new boss come in and sort of pick me up and help me dust myself down and find a way through back from that. But it was really crushing, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because it's happened to me a few times.
I know,
And when I live with depression, as I do, I didn't have any tears, actually, but I went into a sort of gloom for anything up to a week at that time, you know, because you get beaten up, frankly. And the worst part about it is that nobody ever calls it out. Nobody ever says, hey, look, back off a bit there, mate. You're stepping across a line. Nobody says that. It's almost like the other people around the desk, around the table, are saying, well, thank God he's behaving like that because, you know, I don't want to be associated with that sort of behavior. And so they almost say, thank God it's not me that's having to do this.
Yep, absolutely.
And it's a form of cowardice, isn't it?
Well, it is, but then again, I think I've been guilty of that as well. I mean,
so have I, actually.
Easier said than done. It's a power structure, right? And you know, and if you, that's the kind of thing that if you were to challenge that, you know, that would be, you know, to use the time on a phrase, quite career limiting, you know, to speak out like that. So, it is really hard. Just coming back to, you know, what you were saying about the tears, this is something you and I have talked about before. You know, it's what happens to us, but it's also how we respond. And I'm curious to, you know, I'm sure you've talked about this on the show before, but the one thing I did do, I think, is I did talk a lot about it with people around me. And that was something, goes back to my conversation about my dad, you know, when he died, the one thing about my dad is he never talked to anybody about his problems. He was the kind of guy that people always talk to their problems about too. He was a very good listener, but he never spoke about his problems. We always said, you know, we must never let this happen, and we must always talk about our problems if ever any of us are ever feeling, you know, kind of not good in that way. And there have been a couple of times where I've, you know, called both my brothers, and they've both come over, and you know, we've just sort of gone for walks or sat and had a beer and talked, you know, and I know that, you know, I think you now do some talking therapy.
Yes, I do.
But you didn't for a long time. You were very dismissive of it, if I remember.
Yeah, I was. Originally. Yeah, I was. And the reason is, sorry to interrupt, but the reason is because I'm a man and sod off. I don't need any help. I can do this all on my own. And as it turned out, I couldn't. And like you, my father never ever spoke about anything. I mean, I knew hardly anything about him until I emptied his trunk 4 years after he died and found all sorts of stuff about him. I thought, bloody hell, I wish I'd known that. And he never talked about it. Our family never talked about it, certainly not to me. And I just never did. And you bottle these things up, which actually makes it worse because you need, like you need that outlet to relieve the pressure cooker that's going on in your brain.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, I wasn't singling you out in that. That is the
social condition. No, I don't mind being singled out.
Wouldn't be the first or last time.
No, it won't.
it's the social conditioning, and you're right. That's the male archetype, and you know, but it is. That's my point, really. It, you know, and this is your own experience. It can be so damaging. You know, over time. So when you may have, again, if you've said this before on the show, then,
no, it's all right. No, carry on. I like talking about me.
When was it that you finally decided to have the talking therapy, and how did it help?
Right. Well, I as you know, I left Superdry in 2012. Mm-hmm. I have said this before, but anyway, 4 or 5 years of absolute hell, feeling shit. Eventually, after leaving the dining room table just before Christmas and bursting into tears in the lounge, Sue says, you really need to go and see somebody. So I did. I went to see the doctor, got the medicines, and then rubbed my hands together and said, well, that's that cured then, which, of course, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. I then spent the next 5 years coming out of it. So we're probably about 2 years ago now, so 7 years really to get to where I am now. Yeah. And all the way through that, up till about 2018, I refused to have therapy. And
that's what I remember.
I started it, but it wasn't even then in 2018. I think it was 2021, probably, I started.
Wow. Okay.
Weekly. Okay. I was nervous to try and find a therapist, but I got recommended by somebody, which was good. And I now, honestly, I miss it if I don't have it every week. It's bizarre. I just would recommend everybody, if they've got something that they need to talk about that they haven't got somebody close at hand that they feel comfortable to talk about, even their family in certain circumstances, just go and see these people, because they are brilliant at getting underneath the skin and trying to get you to work yourself out, to understand yourself and know the things that you can do and should do, maybe, to make yourself feel better. But there's one thing I wanted to explore a little bit with you, Stuart, is because you went through, you had what, 20 years in industry, something like that? 25 years in industry. Mm-hmm. And I remember when we worked together, it was a relatively short period of time at Foster's Wines.
Yep.
Is I was always very envious of you because of your management style, and you were far more developmental of your staff than I think any other finance director I've ever seen. And you then, I think I may have even said, Christ, you should do some more coaching or something. And I don't know if it made any difference or not, but you then set up your own company, Aim High Leadership, which specializes in coaching. And you've moved on since that into the climate agenda, which is great, because I think we could have a lot of time talking about that, actually, and what that's doing to people's mental health. But anyway, so what gave you the confidence and made you go from what is quite an aggressive environment into helping people and being compassionate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess I touched on it a bit earlier when, you know, kind of I had some coaching myself at Foster's. It was soon after you left, I think, and we were coached individually and collectively as a team there, and it just made a real difference. But I mean, you know, amongst other things, you know, that was the first talking therapy I'd ever had. I mean, coaching is a kind of
Yeah,
coaching
it
therapy,
is. Yeah, it is.
talking therapy. It might be worth just clarifying for people that whereas, you know, there is the difference between coaching and therapy is that in therapy, there's no assumption that you're aiming to achieve anything. There's no kind of future orientation. All you're doing is really just, I mean, that may come into the conversation, but the primary purpose is really just to allow you to uncover what might be making you unhappy or might be, you know, getting in the way of you just being able to exist normally on a day-to-day basis. Whereas coaching is makes an assumption that there's a level of resourcefulness, is the language we use, to be able to do that, and that it's more about, you know, where are you trying to get to and how are you going to try and get there. And that might be both, you know, in your personal life as well as in your professional life. It's a kind of a holistic approach to, you know, the whole human. Where do you want to get to? How do you, you know, what do you aspire to? How are you going to get there?
But it's not a
And
tell, is it? It's not telling people. It's
it, well, both of them, that's what they would have in common, is that neither of them are about telling. I mean, there is a, you know, there is a role, I think, at times to offer ideas to help people work things through. But what I was also going to say is that, you know, coaching, nevertheless, is, you know, there is very often times an element of the conversation which is, you know, how people are dealing with stress in particular, and how people are dealing with their work-life balance, and how people are may also be dealing with issues at home as well as at work, and all of that is in scope of a conversation. And as a coach, one has to be mindful of this question of, is this client resourceful? In other words, does this client have the resources available, you know, to deal with what's going on, or actually is there some other therapy that might be necessary or might be recommended? And so I'm often referring my clients to a therapist, and that therapy might happen alongside the coaching, or it might even happen instead of the coaching, depending on how serious the situation is. So I spend a lot of time, you know, talking to people, and I think, and it's funny because I've got another friend who lives somewhere on a hill halfway between you and me, who is an occupational therapist, which is effectively a it's a qualified doctor who works with people who are on long-term sick and stuff like that, and he probably does a lot more of that, the therapy work in that. And you know, I often say, you know, I'll be talking to people that, you know, might end up seeing him, or my job is to stop people getting to the point where they have to speak to him. You know, and because I do think that's true. I think, you know, a lot of people are closer to the edge than we think in terms of just holding things together, you know, and everybody's putting on a brave face. And you know, you were I the other part of your question was just around, you know, the how I used to be, you know, focused on developing people. That's nice to hear that feedback. I'm not sure everybody thought that. I'm sure I, you know, I know that I suffered from that, you know, having spent 25 years with role models who, many of whom were very much more driving in the old style of leadership paradigm. I know that a lot of that rubbed off on me. It took me a long time to work my way trying to move beyond that kind of behavior. But I always loved, the thing I always loved about my work was the people, actually.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
I,
But
it was
that
not,
shone through. That absolutely shone through.
I, you know, we all enjoyed working for a business that was successful, and I always found the intellectual, you know, kind of challenges of being a part of a team that enabled that was great. But and coaching was just this thing that sort of, you know, was, so as a finance guy, especially like you, always focused on performance, you know, how do we improve performance? And actually coaching, you know, the provenance of coaching is in elite sports. Back in the 70s and 80s, the original seminal book on coaching was called The Inner Game of Tennis,
Oh, I remember
by the
that,
tennis coach who was coaching people like Navratilova at the time. And so a lot of the ideas that came into coaching, and you know, I guess I joined, well, I became a professional coach in 2012, but when, you know, and then so in the last 10 years, it's grown significantly. It was already, that momentum was always already building through the, you know, the 10 years prior to that. But yeah, it's a relatively young profession, and you know, it's a lot of it is like the mindset is, you know, It's not about you're broken, you're fit, you know, you need fixing. It's, you know, you're already wherever you are on your performance curve, your learning curve, you know, there's always somewhere better to go. There's always some, you know, even if you're a bronze medalist, how do you get to gold, you know, and that kind of stuff. So there's this whole thing of how do you improve, and the mechanisms, I suppose, or the philosophy behind coaching is that you only really do that if you go inside and really connect with yourself. You know, on a fully human level, fully authentic with yourself, and not pretending that you're something that you're not, or you know, all of those sort of things that people fall into traps of.
But there's a lot of that going on, isn't there, in work, because people pretend. I mean, particularly in finance, you know as much as I do. Finance is a particularly macho environment to work. And it is all about numbers it's less about people.
It can be.
Yeah, it can be. I think it's getting better. You're right. But
I think it's patchy. I think there are, you know, like I said earlier, generationally, I think there are more people who think this way. But I think that there's, you know, the capitalist pressures still mean that, you know, a lot of bad eggs make it up the chain
and that success and the behavior that leads to that success, people say, that's how you have to behave to be successful. So they mirror it.
Yeah,
that then becomes the culture of the organization. And frankly, it's a pretty horrible place to work.
Yeah.
But coming on to sort of boards of directors, and you've got some guy sat around the table at a board who is exactly that. He's afraid to say anything about what he's feeling and how his mental health is.
Yeah.
Because it could be career limiting for him at that particular point. What do you think the role of the other people round the table could be to help find a way of that person being slightly more open about it?
Well, that's a multi-layered question because, you know, you have to be mindful of the power structure again. You know, if that person is, you know, has a big ego and everything else, then it's often, you know, it can be very difficult, back to that thing of, you know, career limiting to speak out.
Yeah. Well, you suffer in silence, don't you? You know, and if
well, that's right. That's
and
right.
I mean, suffering in silence is as bad as speaking out and taking a risk in some ways.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And it's back to your cowardice point. I agree. I mean, I do hold the view that leadership isn't a role, it's a behavior. And, you know, it's people, you know, people much malign leaders, because we have quite a lot of leaders in society, not just at the moment, but maybe especially so at the moment, you know, who give leadership a bad name. But they're not leaders. They might be in positions that might have titles of leader in them, but they're not, you know.
They have power. They have power, don't they?
Yeah, it's about power. And whereas for me, leadership is not about the power, the role, the structure. It's about the behavior. You know, I think that interestingly, you know, the language I would use is to take a coaching approach, actually, to, you know, so what is it that motivates that board member who is behaving that way, and get curious about how you might be able to change their views, rather than, because, you know, they're probably not going to listen if you just kind of try and tell them your version of the truth. You know, you've got to, I think, if, and this is true, therefore, in all, you know, engaging any stakeholders, whether they be peers, people above you, people beneath you, it's spending time hunkering down and understanding what's going on for them, what motivates them. Because then if you do that, then you're more likely to be able to move on to a conversation where you say, well, in order to get what you want, you know, how could what we're doing here be relevant to that? How could that, you know, what could we do differently here that might help that? Or what might we be doing here that might be getting in the way of that? And that's where you might be able to get to. But I mean, I don't underestimate the difficulty of in power structures of those conversations sometimes being very hard.
Yeah, and when you're in a, as I describe it, and I've said this before, about, you know, you're in a black hole gravity well of depression.
To even go
anywhere near that is impossible. I mean, to actually engage in a conversation sometimes becomes impossible.
Exactly.
So it's how do we give people permission to open up? Because if you look at board directors of PLCs now, and there's very few who actually, you know, have admitted that they have a vulnerability or a weakness or whatever because of mental health, you know. And how many in the FTSE 100 PLC boards, that you're talking probably 1,000 people, maybe more, maybe 1,500. I cannot believe that there isn't some of them who are struggling.
How can we
define a language that allows them to describe what they're feeling, but also an environment where they feel empowered and have permission to speak out?
It's tough, isn't it?
I mean, I know you're hesitating and thinking clearly, but it's such a huge question.
I mean, you know, funnily enough, you know, it reminds me of a parallel of, you know, think of all of the professional football players in the English Football League and how many of them are gay or, you know, and how many of them, you know, we're in a world where, you know, the reality still doesn't, you know, we're there's a culture, a prevalent culture where it's still not, you know, people don't feel that they're free to speak out and be their true selves, which is, you know, it's shocking really in this day and age.
Yeah.
I tend to work at the individual level. I also work at team level, and I also work at organizational level, you know, systemic level. And there's no doubt that the kind of work that the profession I'm part of is, you know, definitely plays a role in bringing this kind of awareness and attention to leaders at all levels in organizations. You know, leadership is, you know, something that has to be done, you know, across organizations, not just in a boardroom.
Yeah.
And so, you know, bringing people's attention to what kind of behavior will be more beneficial for the organization and for people in general is a big part of, I would say that's one part of it. An anecdote, I remember, you know, you were talking about boardrooms and we were talking to one particular non-exec board about what the leadership, you know, behaviors should be for the executive board who we were developing. And they asked us to provide some recommendations. And one of the words I brought in was vulnerability. And the chair of the non-exec board said, "No way, not over my dead body."
I was hoping you were going to say the exact opposite.
I know. And it's because, and it's interesting, isn't it? Because that is part of the traditional paradigm, and words like vulnerability have such a negative connotation for that mindset or for that, you know, that kind of old paradigm thinking. And yet, you know, one of my strongest point of views is that, you know, the most courageous thing to do is to show your vulnerability.
Yeah.
Also, you know, probably one of the most powerful things you can do as a leader, because what you do is that you enable people to realize that you're human and not a machine. And that then, you know, surprise, surprise, enables them to feel as though they could also be perhaps human as well, and that they may also be able to share their vulnerabilities. And, you know, and lo and behold, when people share their vulnerabilities, you find out what's really going on. And so when you find out what's really going on, you can actually start, you know, creating action plans to sort of actually, you know, move from where you are to a better place, both for the individual's concern and for the business. And, you know, that in a nutshell for me is kind of what so many organizations and leaders miss. And it's kind of like the, you know, if I'm honest, it was my realization of that in the context of the coaching I had and where I was at that time back in the, whenever it was, the late 2006, 2007, 2008 period, was kind of what emboldened me to change career, because I was thinking, you know, there's such a need for this, you know, to your point about the 15, you know, the 100 boards and however many people, you know, and that's just the FTSE 100. I mean, there's all these other organizations.
Well, you go the 250, the 350, the FTSE itself.
And even in startups and the whole thing, you know, I mean, it's kind of so that there is such a huge need for these conversations to be happening. And it always amazes me how, you know, I'll go into an organization where there's never been any coaching or this kind of intervention before. You know, obviously that wouldn't be in the blue chips, then, you know, these sorts of conversations would be happening. How effective they are is a question, back to the point about the, you know, power corrupts, etc. But, you know, you'll often go into organizations where people have just never had these conversations before at all, and it can be that's what I love about my work, because when people realize and find a way of using language and you know, emboldening themselves really to sort of have more of these conversations, it's amazing what of a difference it makes. And it comes back to that whole thing of, you know, having the courage to say in a job interview, is work-life balance is important to me, is that okay? I think I mentioned to you, and I did actually ask my son for his permission to mention this, because he has had some mental health challenges over recent years, and you know, I won't go into all the detail of that, but he recently, you know, is changing job and has been, you know, approached for a, you know, a really great job, and he went along and he basically said to them, look, you know, I want to be able to tell you that I have these mental health problems, and I want to be able to know that that's not going to be a problem coming into this role. And interestingly, his new boss who you know said, actually, my husband's suffering from similar things, absolutely fine, total, you know we'll work it out.
How refreshing is that? How old is he? How old's your son?
He's 26.
Right, so he is the next generation coming through, yeah. Isn't he? He's got the best years of his work life.
Ahead. But you know that, and I keep saying to him, I'm just so proud of the courage that he's, you know, he's got. But it, you know, it's true that it's also, we are also now in a, you know, a zeitgeist where that can happen, and that's where my optimism comes from. That, you know, I think there is a shift happening, even though, you know, the power structures and the capitalist system still corrupts. But, you know, I think the there's this groundswell of a generational groundswell of people just saying, no, that, you know, enough. We've got to be able to be more human with each other.
Yeah. And how, do you mind me asking how old her boss, his boss is?
I don't know, actually. I don't know. I would probably hazard a guess of maybe, you know, 10 years older or something, but I don't know.
Yeah, because I just wonder how that conversation would have gone if it had been somebody, older generation, if I can put it like that. You know, would they have had the courage to do it? And, you know, harking back to your comment about over my dead body, you would never, ever, ever say anything like that, would you?
I know.
But wouldn't it be good if a chairman suddenly came out and said, I've got vulnerability, do you mind? You know, that would change the organisation in a few minutes.
Yeah, yeah. It is interesting to think. It comes back to the football thing. It's kind of like, and you know, gay footballers. It's like you just wish that there could be, you know, somebody soon that would just, you know, have somehow find it within themselves to put themselves out there and be a leader, and you know, and really, you know, it would take great courage, wouldn't it? But
it would, because the backlash on social media would be probably horrendous. But actually, the outpouring of warmth and empathy and all of those and gratitude would be immense. Absolutely immense.
I know. Yeah, there's a parallel with, I mean, I sort of, as you said earlier, I work a lot in, you know, the climate space now, and you know, helping leaders think about their sustainability, you know, kind of agenda and regenerative leadership and all that kind of stuff. And there are examples of leaders who have been far more courageous and, you know, with their organizations. Interestingly, one of them, you know, most famous of in recent times was Paul Polman at Unilever, you know, who said, I'm going to stop focusing on quarterly results. You know, we're going to start taking the longer term, and, you know, we've got an ambition to reduce our carbon footprint. He was one of the first, you know, to go public with all of that. And, you know, that was an example of amazing leadership, you know, kind of courageous leadership, which, you know, in the face of, you know, directly into the face of the capitalist pressure. But of course, you know, there are other examples of others who have followed, but, you know, as soon as the business starts underperforming, it's amazing how quickly the pressure comes on.
Yeah. The shareholders, you know, I want to go and talk on a bit about wellbeing initiatives at work, but before we go there, you know, the pressure on boards from outside shareholders is immense, and they want to see them being, you know, carbon neutral, looking after their staff, the whole ESG agenda. But when it comes down to it, they don't really care about that. What they care about is profit and money and dividends and so on, and which is the capitalist thing coming in again.
Yeah, I want to say yes, and I mean, I think there are some who really don't have any more than that. The one of the privileges of all of the one-to-one coaching I do, Chaz, though, is that, you know, I do, when you get people on their own, they don't have to worry about, you know, what other people might think of what they're saying, right? So you have this sort of intimacy and privacy and confidentiality in the conversation. And, you know, I would say, there are a few sociopaths around, but I would say that the majority of people, I'm talking about, you know, senior leaders in FTSE companies, etc., and across the spectrum as well. I haven't coached many people who don't have some level of, you know, awareness of the importance of the environment, awareness of the importance of social issues. You know, people have different politics, but you know, it's I think that you know it's a bit like it's probably politically incorrect to bring this in as an example, but you know, I've spoken to people, you know, German people whose families were, you know, involved with the Nazis, and you know, we know that whole story of how, you know, you're in a system where, you know, you're kind of it's beguiling, you know it's alluring, you're brought into something which you don't really fully appreciate the negative impacts of. And it may be a bit of an extreme example to use the parallel of Nazism, but actually, if you think about the damage that we're doing to the planet, you know, which is leading to, you know, if you look at all of the very compelling scientific evidence now, and the, you know, the 99.9%, you know, consensus of all of the leading scientists, you know, in the world, you know, we are moving towards an absolute climate catastrophe. And, you know, the consequences of which is going to make the Holocaust look like a, you know, an afternoon picnic.
Yeah. So what do you think they grade ESG agenda? The ESG agenda lower than the profit agenda. I'm talking about external shareholders, and I'd be interested if you've actually interviewed or coached anybody who works in an investment bank, for example.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, what they call, you know, kind of patient capital emerging. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about how, you know, the European, you know, investment industry as a whole has been leaning towards more orientation towards, you know, greener assets, if you like, compared to in the US. And there's a, you know, as with all of these things, that then becomes an issue because, you know, there's competition between the European and the American, you know, investment, you know, kind of business, frankly. And but I you know, there's so many different ways that I could answer this question. I mean, back to my point earlier, I think there's a spectrum of people, and some are much, I think the people who are better informed, frankly, realize that we are rapidly going to be moving towards a situation where, you know, in some sectors more than others, we're going to start moving towards some very seriously stranded assets.
Yeah.
In old technologies, which are going to be no longer acceptable. And, you know, it's interesting if you look at the shift that's happening in public opinion. And again, that's much happening much more so here in the UK than it is in America. But, you know, it is becoming very much more mainstream, you know, the public awareness, you know, everything, you know, and over the last 5 years, especially, you know, from Greta to, you know, Extinction Rebellion to, you know, Attenborough and all of the, you know, the coverage on the news of all the disasters, which so many of which seem to be where, you know, whether the science, the linkage to the science is saying that they're almost certainly consequences of what's happening. And if you really want to look seriously at some of the projections, Chaz, I don't know how much you look at this stuff, but it's absolutely the tipping points on reversible, non-reversible change in climate systems is happening. It's kind of, you know, it leads us on to, doesn't it, you know, then how does the world, you know, deal with that, and how do people sustain their mental health in the face of that, as well as everything else that's going on?
Yes, I mean, that's the question I was going to ask you, actually, because if you think about just one of the aspects of climate change is migration,
right? Yes.
So, yeah, you know, broadly speaking, the tropics becomes uninhabitable, everybody goes north or south. Well, the vast majority of the land mass is north, so, you know, there's potentially 1.5 billion people who are going to want to move in the next 50-100 years.
Yep.
Right. So some of those will end up coming to here. That just puts so much more pressure on people and the prospects for conflict, you know, blah, 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 blah. International conflict, that is, as in Ukraine. you know, how the hell do we prepare for that, for people's mental health at work? Well, in their lives, let alone just at work.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a whole sort of part of the climate movement which is, you know, increasingly looking at this both in terms of I'm trying to remember the name that's the predicted how to deal with the predicted. We're almost beyond the point of getting rid of things. I'm getting some noise here. Are you getting this?
Yeah, I did get a bit of noise. Is there a bit of noise? Can you hear a bit of noise?
No. Anyway, sorry.
There was a little. We can get that bit echo out, maybe. Or something.
I think it's gone now. There's the whole question of how do we, you know, avoid climate, you know, the climate disaster. How do we prevent what's been going on? How do we? But then there's also the adaptation, you know, and there's this thing called deep adaptation, which is, you know, how do we start preparing to hunker ourselves down for what is, you know, almost certainly inevitable. So there's that, which is just the very, you know, the practicalities of how do we, you know, that's obviously going to have a lot to do with, you know, sea defences, you know, on the close to the coast, and, you know, and all of those kinds of things.
What proportion of the world lives on the coast? Yeah. 20% or something ridiculous? Yeah,
it's big numbers.
Some countries will just disappear.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the, you know, the whole piece around, yeah, climate anxiety. I mean, there are some dreadful statistics about the levels of climate anxiety, especially in the younger generation.
Because they're heading for it, aren't they? Basically, I mean, you exactly. know, you and I, luckily or unluckily, probably won't get to the worst bit.
We'll see. I mean, no, not to the worst bit. I suspect we'll see a lot more before we have a fair innings, Chaz. But I don't know if you've come across Clover Hogan. She's an amazing climate activist, still in her early 20s, but she was. She was already representing the youth activism at the climate Paris climate talks in 2015, and she, you know, she does an awful lot of work on just helping the younger generation deal with the, you know, with climate anxiety. She'd be a great person to get on your show.
Well, okay, we noted that. Can we note that one down? Yes, it's been noted. Apparently, yeah. They're waving at me.
I interviewed her. For one of the the Climate Coaching Alliance, which I'm part of leading, we do events where we bring people in and have these sorts of interviews as well. I mean it's a huge question, Chaz.
There's no real answer to it, is there? Because if you look at all the trends, it's not just temperature, is it? And it's not just sea levels rising. It's, you know, it's housing, health, education. I mean, it's everything. You know,
and social and social, you know, stability. You know, I mean, I think the most obvious prediction really is that as things break down in the environmental breakdown, which creates these mass migrations, then, you know, you're going to end up in much more civil war and unrest, social instability, and, you know,
most wars, aren't they, are to do with territory and resources.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
And a lot of it is religion based, but forget that bit for the moment. It's all about so here we are. We've got a population, I don't know, of 100 million or something.
Yeah,
you know, we can't feed our people because the tropics are uninhabitable and can't grow anything. So what do? We go and pinch it off somebody else.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that we would do that, but that is the trend.
We're going to be the ones that will be, you know, the ones with the resources, probably. I mean, it depends. You never know what happens if the North Atlantic drift and, you know, the Gulf Stream shifts dramatically. Our weather could also be, you know, significant.
Yes. The only thing, I'm sorry, just we need to be wrapping up, I think, in a minute. But, you know, where we live on Cleve Hill, and I live just on the slopes just below Cleve Hill. If climate change happens to, you know, a medium to worse degree, we'll end up with a sea view. It'll be marvellous.
Yeah.
The whole country will be a series of islands.
Always look on the bright.
Yes, that's right.
It's pretty grim. But all I was going to say about that is that I do think that at the end of the day, you know, you look at it all and it's very easy just to go into despair. I mean, it would be great if we could move most people beyond disbelief, because I think a lot of people are still in denial. I think there is a process of moving from denial. Certainly in America, there's a hell of a lot of people.
Yes, there are. Yes.
Chunk of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
But if we, you know, there's moving people beyond denial to acceptance. But then beyond acceptance, there's still so much more to do, because it's like, well, you rapidly move into despair. It's like, well, how, this is never going to change. How are we going to make a difference? And I do think that at the end of the day, it's a binary choice. You either do something or you don't.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you do something, whatever happens, you know, whatever action does take place will, you know, mitigate to some degree what will happen. It may not be able to prevent it. It may not be able to solve it. But every single action that all of us takes, and then there's a whole separate conversation about, well, what is that? You know, from everything within your own carbon footprint through, you know, all of the conversations you have, you know, this is a conversation that we should all be having with all of our friends and families and certainly at work and customers and clients. And that's my rule of thumb, is I don't have a client, you know, or a client conversation that doesn't include this.
Yeah.
It can be grim at times, and it may not always be what people want to hear, but, you know, that's, yeah.
So, but I think what you just said about, you know, it doesn't, you can't sit back and do nothing. You've got to try and do something, right? And whatever you do, you just should try and do something to help that along. In the same way that, you know, what you're trying to do through Aim High Leadership is what I'm in terms of climate now, because you've morphed into that, haven't you, which is great. I'm trying to do the same thing with this program and with other things that are going on to try and help people to move the mental health agenda at work, particularly for senior people. And you know, they always say, don't they, well, if I can help just one person, then that would be great. Well, I mean, genuinely, that's exactly what I would like to do.
Totally agree. And also, you know, action breeds confidence. And I think, you know, finding a meaningful cause in life, whatever it is, you know, is a really important, you know, antidote to mental health challenges. I think a lot of the times, you know, mental health problems emerge where people feel as though there isn't much purpose to life.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? Do you know what? That's exactly what happened when I left Super, when I got fired from Superdry, to clarify. I suddenly had no purpose. And, you know, I'm the breadwinner. Sue's the housewife, to be put some stereotypes around it. And we agreed that very early on, that she'd bring up the family and I'd earn the money. And I'm not fulfilling my side of the agreement. And so you end up with no purpose. But the best thing that's happened to me over the last 4 or 5 years is doing what I'm doing now, because I suddenly do have a purpose, in the same way that you have a purpose with your climate agenda and getting people to think seriously about it.
I think the work you're doing, Chaz, is so important. And I just so hope that, you know, the time isn't long before we really do have more people speaking out. And I think even this kind of radio program is, you know, is an important stepping stone. It's an enabler, because the more that you normalize the conversation, the more you're likely to normalize the behavior. So kudos to you for all that you do.
Well, and to you as well, of course, Stuart. But honestly, I could talk to you all day, actually, Stuart. So thanks ever so much. Yeah, great to speak to you. And you must buy me a beer soon. If not, just give me the cash. It'll be fine.
we'll do it very soon, mate. Thanks very much.
Cheers. Bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.